The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. There's a kind of beat playing in the background.
Yeah.
So this is a really cool experience. If I just bounce a little bit while I talk, I hope that's okay. Wow, what a conference. Our topic today, I'm just gonna dive right in. Our topic today is slavery and capitalism. The fact that people were enslaved in this country, I think, is still visible in this country. If you walk around, it's visible. If you look at, oh, I need to speak up. I'll lean a little, is that better?
Yes.
Okay. The fact that people were enslaved here is visible. It's visible on maps of health and wealth in this country. You can see exactly where the slaves were to this day. And it's visible in our present politics. Last summer, the President of the United States of America defended people who were defending Confederate monuments from being torn down. And he said something very interesting. He said, this is a quote, "So this week, it is Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson is coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week? And is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?" Well, actually, I agree with the president on that. That's actually a good question. Like, are we gonna start questioning all the so-called founding fathers of this country? And the answer is yes, we are, yes! Where does it stop? And the answer is, it does not stop. It does not stop, is the answer. So this is an occasion to talk about slavery. And with economic crisis and strikes and socialists running for office and winning, it's also a good time to be talking about capitalism. And no doubt you're in this room having some feeling that these two things are connected in some way. Slavery and capitalism are somehow related. They have something in common. So I'm going to try to do three things here. I'm going to first talk about some of what I consider to be key ideas, or kind of core ideas that we need to hold on to about slavery and capitalism. Secondly, I'm going to suggest that there are some important ways in which slavery can serve as a kind of metaphor for us, for capitalism. And thirdly, I'm going to suggest that there are some important ways that slavery cannot serve as a metaphor for capitalism. End of use. So first, some key ideas. We're coming up on the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first Africans who were kidnapped and brought here. That will be August of 2019. It'll be exactly 400 years since 20 and odd Africans arrived on the shores of the British colony of Virginia. And by the way, for those of you working in ISO branches or DSA branches or what have you, I think we should mark this and think about ways to mark this and think about that 400-year span. In the middle of that century, in the 16th century, British colonists in Virginia figured out that they were not going to get rich mining for gold or precious metals, but that they could get rich growing tobacco. Tobacco at first was mostly grown by indentured servants from England, but later Africans became the primary labor source, a point to which I will return. So here we have people kidnapped from Africa growing tobacco in the North American mainland and growing sugar in the Caribbean, and then there's cotton. Tobacco was the first luxury good that became available to everybody, became a mass commodity, not just for elites. Slave labor made this possible. Slave labor made possible a world where workers, working people, working for wages, first in Europe, and then everywhere, depend upon meeting their basic needs by being able to purchase products made by somebody else they never met far, far away. Things that we all still purchase, like underwear and blue jeans. All of this has this origin in this moment. Cotton production really takes off with the invention of the cotton gin in 1794, which pulls the seeds off of it and strips it away to the bare thing that you can manipulate with further mechanical processes. The newly founded, at that moment, still a new US government, then pushes for more cotton to be grown, and they need more cotton lands, and so that's why they push westward. They go over the mountains. They terrorize and murder and get more land from Native Americans in order to grow more cotton. There's a wonderful, horrible passage in Edward Baptiste's book, The Half Has Never Been Told, where it describes what it's like to be forced to walk from Virginia to the Mississippi Delta. You know, how else are they going to get you there to grow the cotton? They're going to walk you there. And how are they going to make sure that you don't run away while they're walking you there? They're going to chain you to everybody else they're walking there by the wrists and by the hands. So you're walking hundreds and hundreds of miles chained to somebody else. So even the swinging of your arms, the swinging of your legs, anything that you need to do to stop, to use the restroom, to pause, anything is dependent on what maybe 49 other people do who are also moving along. So we think about the Middle Passage. We think about the, you know, 13 million people kidnapped from Africa and brought to the Americas. Roughly 2 million of them died in the ships, you know, in the Middle Passage, crammed into the bottom of boats, and roughly 10 million survived. But then there's this other Middle Passage. There's this other Middle Passage where maybe you had some sense of you were enslaved. You're on the Eastern Seaboard, but maybe you're able, you know, people you know and are related to are in kind of close proximity to you. You have some sense of a community that you carve out for yourself in some little space afforded to you, and then there's the cotton boom. And now, once again, everything you know is broken up. Every relationship you have is broken up once again, disrupted once again. Whatever you created is gone because they put you in that coffin and march you for hundreds of miles into what becomes Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana. From 1780s to 1865, they marched 1 million people. Despite the ban on the slave trade in 1807, slave ships kept coming. There's a remarkable book that I highly recommend everybody read. It's written by Zora Neale Hurston, a writer and anthropologist, but it was only recently published because she couldn't find a publisher for it at the time. But it's about the very last slave ship. There's a man who survived from the very last slave ship that arrived in 1860. The ban was 1807. This ship arrives, it's called the Clotilla. It arrives in 1860, and Oluwale Kosola, who later goes by Cujo Lewis, is on that ship. He arrives from Benin. He's a slave for 5 years, and then for 1 year, and then there's a civil war, 4 years, and then 1865, he's free. And so, of course, naturally, he wants to go back home. And he and the other people who are on the ship are trying to figure out a way to get together some money and get back home, but they have all of the difficulties of black people in the United States post-emancipation, and they're never able to make it back. And in 1927, Zora Neale Hurston tracks him down. He's the last living member of the last slave ship to arrive. He's the last person who grew up as a teenager, like in Africa, and he was here and was a slave for 5 minutes, and then most of his life is as a free, he's a window to a whole history. And that book just came out, it's called Barracoon, which is the Spanish name of the camps that they had, the barracks for people on the African coast. You gotta read that book. Sorry? Barracoon. I think the full name is Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo by Zora Neale Hurston. I'm gonna try to shout out a bunch of books in this. And I'll also gladly provide a list of things I read afterwards, if that helps. So there's all these great new books coming out. There's a lot of great research that people are doing about this history, and Of course, it's showing that there's an indictment to be made of everybody. It's not just about the U.S. South. It's everybody is involved in slavery and profiting from it. Like there's Craig Stephen Wilder's book, Ebony and Ivy. It's all of the Ivy League universities are implicated in the slave trade. It's the Quakers, it's the philanthropists, it's like all the goodies, like all the high-minded reformers, like everybody is implicated. And so that's why I think it's important for us to hold on to the idea that reparations is not about every white person cutting every black person a check. It's about saying that Lehman Brothers, Aetna, JP Morgan, New York Life, Barclays would not exist were it not for the profits from slavery, from unrequited labor for hundreds of years, and they should pay up. And the more you dig into the story, the more you realize it's also a story about tremendous violence. Like, that is the origins of this country and this system, violence. I also want to highly recommend Ibram Kendi's book, Stamped from the Beginning. If you read that book alongside, I forget the subtitle, but it's a history of racist ideas, basically. You put that book alongside Edward Baptiste's, and just count how many times heads are placed on pikes as a warning. Like, this is the enlightened, civilized, freedom-loving beacon of light and liberty to the world, yet for them to take new territory in Massachusetts, you know, in enlightened liberal Massachusetts, heads are on pikes as a warning to the local tribes. So then after slave revolts, they're putting heads of the revolting, of the rebelling slaves on pikes as a warning to other, I mean, this is the origins of the United States. It really is a validation of a basic idea that Marx laid out in Das Kapital, that capitalism's origins were violent and bloody. He said that capital comes in its birth dripping from head to foot, from every pore, with blood and dirt. And that's why I think people are right to have a reaction of disgust when they see migrant children locked in cages and a kind of liberal response that's like, this is not who we are. Like, no, no, this is exactly who we are. Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave and great abolitionist, asked the question, when asked to speak on the occasion of the 4th of July, he said, what to the slave is the 4th of July? We could ask the same question. What to the migrant child separated from their family is your 4th of July? Capitalism as a system, as a global system, has actually been quite stingy with things like democracy and rights. Actually, it's the other way around. It's that the people they kidnapped and brought here were the people who had the most expansive vision of democracy and rights. I mean, everything that we've got that's in that vein in this country, we owe to the black struggle. Public schools in the South, birthright citizenship, the 14th Amendment, voting rights, civil rights. We don't have enough monuments to the people who really fought to make democracy in any way a meaningful thing. And in that sense, the president is also right when he says that Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is getting recognized more and more.
One of these waters.
Water?
Oh.
All right. Another thing that I want to talk about here just briefly is slavery, racism, and origins of white supremacy. It's important to pull these things apart because slavery is a very, very old institution. It's ancient. And for most of the history of slavery, it's not racial at all. Everybody gets, or almost everybody at some point in their history, gets enslaved as a people. It's a very widespread phenomenon that really is never are people anywhere else in the world categorized by so-called races. And therefore meant to be slaves for life. That's not the way slavery works for all of human history up until the time period that we're talking about now. You know, the Slavic people, it's the same root word because they were frequently the source of slaves in the ancient world, feudal world. And in many cases, ancient slavery was more flexible, more patriarchal. You were, you had opportunities to advance, so to speak. You could become management. You could rise to important positions. You could become free and then join the regular community of people. Like, the boundary between slavery and freedom was not always so policed as it came to be under capitalist slavery. And I think this is a really important point to understand. It's much of what we identify with slavery and what we think of when we think of slavery are actually the particulars of capitalist slavery. Ira Berlin, who just passed, has a wonderful book called Many Thousands Gone, in which he makes a distinction between slave societies and societies with slaves. And there is a difference between a society where some people are enslaved, and like there's some workers, and you put the wife to work in the fields and you have a slave. Like, that's a different thing from a slave society, where slavery forms the basis, the fundamental relationship that shapes all other relationships in the society. Robin Blackburn says it's the difference between being sold because you were captured and being captured so that you could be sold. There's a fundamental way in which slavery and the traffic in human beings and the commodification, see, capitalism is about generalized commodity production, producing not for use, but for exchange. And under capitalist slavery, the slave, just like under wage labor, the slave too is a commodity to be bought and sold, to be financed, to be mortgaged. Slavery under capitalism is very different than ancient slavery. In the Americas, slaves are producing commodities. Commodities to be worked up in industry and sold on a global market. Their fate, the pace of their work is tuned to the rise and fall of the price of that commodity. The pressure on the slave owners to drive them is not about the psychology of that person. Psychotic or crazy or gentle or weak, whatever might be going on in that person's head, they face an external coercion because for most of them, they went into debt in order to purchase human beings. There's a mortgage on their slaves. One historian says in South Carolina in the 1840s, more than half of all the slaves, hear me, more than half of all the slaves who were sold by courts on behalf of creditors. Like, in other words, you could fail as a slave owner, and then they take your slaves away from you so that someone else can succeed with them. Like, you're not guaranteed, we're not just gonna let you stay there unproductive with slaves. There is a pressure on them. So slavery in North America has a different character. And what about racism? Well, that is part of this brew that I think gives rise to racism in the modern sense. That's part of these pressures, this situation, which is unique and new in world history, then gives rise to other problems that the planters face, problems of rebellion. And I think I don't want to go all through it because, I don't have time. How am I doing?
Less than 20 minutes.
Thank you. Okay. I don't want to go all through it, but I'll say a few things about it. But just, there is tremendous clarity, I think, in the Black radical tradition on this point. And that is that this moment, and whether it's Barbara Fields or C.L.R. James or Eric Williams, I think they all kind of come to the, even Martin Luther King, like all kind of come to the same conclusion that this moment creates a new thing that we know of as race and therefore racism. Here's a quote from Eric Williams, who has a wonderful book that everybody, it's a great starting point for thinking through these things called Capitalism and Slavery. The features of the man, writes Williams, his hair, color, and dentifrice, his subhuman characteristics so widely pleaded, were only the later rationalizations to justify a simple economic fact that the colonies needed labor and resorted to Negro labor because it was cheapest and best. This was not a theory. It was a practical conclusion deduced from the personal experience of the planter. He would have gone to the moon if necessary for labor. Africa was nearer than the moon. Nearer, too, than the more populous countries of India and China. But their turn was to come. We think of white supremacy and racism as a kind of constant. And it is a constant. I mean, you kind of can't go wrong with that assumption, more or less. But it is important to watch and learn something from the way it gets constructed in the first place, when it wasn't a constant before. The very first construction of it took time, actually. It did not flow from the fact of having Africans as people in colonial Virginia in the 1600s. It was not automatic that therefore we're going to deny them everything, keep them slaves for life, not allow them to participate in the community. That is not an assumption. You know how we know that? Because they kept very good records, and especially legal records. And we see them coming up with new laws all the time over the course of, 100 years. Just take 100 years, from 1619 to roughly 1723. There's a whole bunch of laws where it's basically like, when little kids are playing and then suddenly they're losing, so then they change the rules. Like, okay, new rule. You're not allowed to do that. That's basically what kept happening. But what is most remarkable to me is that if they arrive in 1619, you think, oh, new rule, 1620. You can't do anything, No. Black people don't lose the right to vote in Virginia for 100 years. 1723, they're like, new rule, you can't vote. Thank you. Whoa, that really tells you something. First of all, it tells you people were voting. People did participate. They owned property. They owned slaves. They sued what we would call white people in court and won. They owned weapons. Listen to this. This is the Attorney General of Virginia. Of Virginia! In 1723, when they're gonna take away the right to vote. He says, wait a minute. We are? Are we sure we wanna do this? Here's what he did. I'm going to read you his exact words. I cannot see, this is the quote, I cannot see why one freeman, now freeman, granted, okay, we're talking about free black people. I cannot see why one freeman should be used worse than another merely upon account of his complexion. Really? Just account of his complexion? To vote at elections of officers, either for a county or parish, etc., is incident to every freeman who is possessed of a certain proportion of property, and therefore when several Negroes have merited their freedom and obtained it, and by their industry have acquired that proportion of property so that the above-mentioned incidental rights of liberty are actually vested in them, for my own part, I am persuaded that it cannot be just by a general law, without any allegation of crime, or other demerit whatsoever, to strip all free persons of a black complexion, parentheses, some of whom may perhaps be of considerable substance, from those rights which are justly valuable to every free. In other words, this was a struggle over who is gonna get what, who is gonna be in what position, and it was not automatic in the course of the struggle that it would become the way it became, in other words. That is important, I think, for us to hold on to. Okay, let me say something about slavery as a metaphor. I think slavery is useful to us as a metaphor for thinking about our own condition. Actually, go back and read Capital, Volume 1. It's shot through with the idea that slavery is a metaphor for the condition of workers under capitalism. Here's a quote. Whilst the cotton industry introduced child slavery in England, he's saying basically the conditions of children in England are child slavery, he's saying, it gave in the United States a stimulus to the transformation of earlier, more or less patriarchal slavery into a system of commercial exploitation. In fact, in other words, he's saying patriarchal slavery, this old ancient institution, transformed and became a commercial exploitation thing in the New World. In fact, the veiled slavery of wage workers in Europe needed for its pedestal slavery pure and simple in the New World. The veiled slavery of wage workers arises on a pedestal of slavery pure and simple in the New World, the veiled slavery. And in fact, the first labor movement in this country railed against what they called wage slavery. They saw the first people organizing a labor movement in this country. There's a book on this called Seizing Freedom by David Roediger, where he goes through all the ways that people looked at slavery, and especially after, this is after the Civil War, the process of abolition. And they saw that what the slaves did to get out of their circumstance, they saw it as a metaphor for what they need to do to get out of their circumstance. And he even suggests, Roediger suggests, that Marx's language in the First International of calling for a self-emancipation is based on what everybody just observed as a self-emancipation of slaves. That's what people took from the Civil War they just watched happen. They viewed it as a self-emancipation and said, we've got to do the same thing. So there's a history to seeing this. I was thinking about this last night during the teacher panel when the teacher, I believe from West Virginia, said, I own my own labor. Like, that was a revelation to her is remarkable. I think that another thing that's useful about thinking about slavery as a metaphor for our condition is the way that it's easier to think about systems in relation to individuals. Like, we would laugh at the way somebody would, you know, recommend improving the lives of slaves. Like, no, you have to abolish slavery. Like, we understand there's a system they're in. You have to, everything else, you know, short of getting rid of that system is somehow inadequate. We kind of fundamentally understand that because now that system was overthrown. So that is helpful for us as thinking about a metaphor. Like, there's all kinds of ways in which we struggle to break out of a more individualistic or reform orientation. Like, slaves who ran away frequently could be diagnosed with a medical condition, drapetomania. Like, something's wrong with you. No, something's not wrong with you. But often we diagnose people in our society with all kinds of things that actually are not, cannot be diagnosed within the realm of an individual, but have to do with the system in which they live. It's useful for thinking about the possibility of abolition. Something, you know, the abolition movement started as a small movement, an impossible movement. Overthrow slavery? Like, how are you going to do that? How are you going to get rid of the slave owners? Like, how is this going to happen? All of it just seems impossible. Totally, totally crazy. They were treated as crazy until it became inevitable. Until it became something that was obvious to everybody that had to happen. There's so many things like this that were like rapid transformations. They're really useful for us for thinking about how change works. Like the idea of arming slaves, preposterous. John Brown was hanged. He's a crazy person. And then the Union Army goes marching into the South singing John Brown's body. Like, we're the army of John Brown. Arming the slaves, of course we're gonna arm the slaves. Have you seen the slaves with arms? Like, they're amazing. Like, that, something that seemed crazy and impossible became policy, became the policy of the US government. That rapid transformation is part of the way that change works, and I think that's important for us. Another thing is the pressure that created all of these changes is, I don't want to take anything away from Lincoln. I think he's an incredible figure in history for all kinds of reasons that I will get into. But for the purposes of this talk, I want to emphasize the role of slaves themselves and the role, and not just in the United States, but on a global scale, the role of the Haitian Revolution in opening a whole era of abolition and beginning the pressure that led to abolition globally. There's a wonderful book by Laurent, of course you should read C.L.R. James' book, Black Jacobins, but also read Laurent Dubois' book, Avengers of the New World. It's a remarkable book about the Haitian Revolution. And what he argues is that actually in, 1804, Haiti's vision of democracy was far greater and more expansive than anywhere else in the globe. Like, we always hold up like the American Revolution and the French Revolution, but it was the Haitian Revolution that really had the most expanded vision of who should be a citizen, of who should be included in a democratic republic. There's a way in which you start to flip the perspective and look at it from the perspective of the activity of the people of African descent all over the Atlantic world, and you realize the contributions that they're making, and it really changes your view. I have to admit that when I was growing up in school and we talked about slavery, I was ashamed. Like, I would cringe whenever the topic came up at school, like, oh God, like, this is the story of my people, like, degraded and humiliated, and like, there's nothing you know, there's no vindication for us in it. But then when, the more you dig into it, the more you realize, it's like, no, actually, we rocked the whole world. We made the modern world. Like, we survived this, and then we overthrew it through our persistent efforts. And so I went from, you know, being ashamed to being quite proud to be part of that tradition. And then my father did some research in our family and found that one of my ancestors was a black slave owner, and I went back to being ashamed again. Okay. Fortunately, slave owning is not genetic. All right, lastly, I'm going to just say something about why slavery is not a metaphor for capitalism, why it's not actually a perfect metaphor for us. There's problems with that. The first thing is that slavery was part of the global capitalist system. The relationship between these two, between slavery and capitalism, is unequal. It's, you can imagine abolishing slavery, but the slave owners, you know, the industrial capitalists can get rid of the slave owners, but the slave owners could not have gotten rid of the industrial capitalists. Actually, because their whole enterprise depended on the global industrial world, of which the triangular trade and their production of commodities was a part. That's why their commodities were so needed. So it's an unequal relationship, the slave regimes and the growing industrial capitalist world. And so it took revolution and pressure and slave revolts, but eventually the industrial capitalists did come around to the idea that these people had to go. And they did fund and support armies that burned their way through the South and killed those people and, like, you know, destroyed everything they owned. So that is different and not something that's likely to happen in what we're trying to do. What's interesting, though, to think about is that what they were after was squashing a slave owner's rebellion. The rebellion of those people, as Barbara Fields always says, it's not about whether or not white people were going to be on top, it's about which white people were going to be on top. And so they wanted to squash the slave owner's rebellion, but what they did not want to squash was cotton. And so for them, once that was successfully accomplished, then the old problem remains. Who's going to grow the cotton? Who's going to grow the tobacco? Who's going to grow the rice? Who's going to get back to the business of commodity, more or less monoculture, agriculture? Who's going to do that? And people, black people in the US South, and really people all over the world, if you take a global perspective, mostly what they wanted to do was mind their own damn business, like, leave me alone, give me my land that I've been working on, and let me subsist with my family and make a little bit of community around me. And maybe if I have a little surplus, maybe I'll take that little surplus to the market so I can have a little bit of cash. Like one Georgia planter, Eric Foner in his book, that's Du Bois, another great book. But Eric Foner has a book on Reconstruction, which he tells many of these stories of black people who, after the Civil War, start like forming little communities and growing their own stuff. And like they're like, we're free, this is it. And then the government comes and eventually says, well, no, actually, you can't do that. Like, we've given you this land, but we have to take it back from you now. And people are literally in disbelief. Like, they cannot believe that after what just happened and the role they just played in saving the nation, that now this is going to be taken away from them. But their vision is remarkably consistent with the vision of people like them in India, the vision of people like them in Russia. It's remarkably consistent. Like, people want to be left alone on their land to grow stuff and, like, have their life and be self-sufficient, be independent. They do not want to be dependent on a global market and the fluctuating price of some single crop that everything they're doing rides on. That is not how they want to live. And so there is a global problem. How do you get these people to do that? Once you get rid of the chains and whips, how are you going to get these people? It's the same problem, really, that the slave owners solved with slavery. But now once you've squashed the slave owners' rebellion, you still have that problem. How are you? You have to get them. You're determined to build this industrial world. How are you going to get them to grow these crops? And so there are huge battles, and Sven Beckert's book, The Empire of Cotton, goes through this on a kind of global scale. There's battles everywhere, all over the world. All over the world. in the 19th century to try to fight with peasants, kick them off their land, create taxes, create some kind of mechanism of coercion to try to get them to grow crops for a commodity market, to grow like one crop that we want you to grow for a commodity market. And I think really, once again, we can see that there's a source to all the violence and oppression and everything that gets visited back on black people in the US South in this time is about that pressure to get them back to work. The black codes, the Klan, all of this is about getting them back to work. And here too, I think, we have trouble with thinking about the metaphor, because their dream was a kind of independent landowning dream. And like, what's our dream? Like, I think our dream has to be different. And I was thinking about this when I saw the Boots Riley movie, where there's like, I'm not giving anything away. He said, no, you know, please don't give away spoilers. But it's a remarkable film in part because it shows something that is more latent in our society than is usually discussed, and that is the tension between the possibility of kind of making it as an individual, and like that being freedom, a kind of financial freedom that you could get from like making it, you know, versus what we could achieve, a kind of collective freedom that we could achieve through struggle, through organizing, through solidarity, which is not obvious to everybody and is not always on the agenda. It is not always there and accessible to people, but is part of what I think we have to, is part of what I think we're fighting for and trying to put out there. All right, so let me just close by saying that I think understanding the ferocity and the violence and brutality of American slavery and capitalism is a more honest picture of American history, and one that is desperately needed. Anybody shocked by the horrors of slavery should also be shocked by the horrors of capitalism in our present society. The irrepressible, what people describe as an irrepressible conflict in the past between slave owners and industrial capitalists, between lords of the lash and lords of the loom, today I think we should describe as an irrepressible conflict between capital and labor. The Trumps of the world fear this harsher, more honest look at American history, because peering into the past and looking at the relationship between capitalism and slavery has radical implications for the present. But we, who know that there is still a transformation yet to come, have nothing to fear from this history and have everything to gain. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.